This is Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com.
Greetings, super friends. My name is Sonia Simone, and these are the confessions of a pink-haired marketer. For those who don't know me yet, I am a co-founder and the chief content officer for Copyblogger Media. I'm also a champion of running your business and your life according to your own rules. As long as you don't lie and you don't hurt people, this podcast is your official pink permission slip to run your business or your career exactly the way you think you should. And this week, I am picking up again my conversation with John T. Unger about marketing for creative products and creative individuals. So let's dive back into that conversation.
And we tell different kinds of stories, but there is that big story piece of the brain that is always hungry. And maybe more so now, you know, that we are in a Home Depot world, that we are in a world of mass story, mass production, you know, that there is a longing, and I think that is a big part of what artists do sell, is a longing for a recording artist that's not auto-tuned and, you know, a sculpture that's made by somebody's hands and, you know.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I get people who are like, well, but I could go buy a fire pit at Home Depot for $100. I'm like, you absolutely can. You know,
right.
Not this, though.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only going to last for a year or two. And, you know, over a couple of decades, you'll have spent as much as you would if you buy this. But, you know, I mean, it's funny because I only just learned what auto-tune was actually a few days ago, and I was just so freaking appalled. I thought it was something slightly different. But, you know, I spent the whole next morning thinking, as much as digital media has made it possible for me to make a living, in a way that would have been a lot harder to do if I was shackled to a local economy and a gallery system.
Yeah.
As much as that's the case, I very much have a longing for a time when everything was analog, and if you wanted to make something, you had to be good at something to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm learning piano right now, and there's just no freaking way to cheat.
Right, there's no hack.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like I'm trying to play Professor Longhair tunes that are really complicated a year after starting. And of course, it's incredibly frustrating because that's like, you know, you should probably play for 10 years first, but that's not how I do things. But you know, it's frustrating, but there's no way to cheat. You just have to keep banging your hands on the keys until you get the right sound.
Yeah.
And there's something about that that's just so much more satisfying and real. You know, and I mean, the piano I play is a digital keyboard, but I mean, you know.
That's the great paradox. You know, we're all using all these, I mean, the whole maker culture, you know, is all very digitally connected to one another. And so you go to a place and you make a thing out of wood with a tool, and then, you know, you connect with your friend who lives in Norway or Kuala Lumpur, and you send him a picture of it digitally, you know?
Yeah, you know.
It's cool, yeah.
It's an interesting, you know, and it's. I think you just have to kind of find your balance.
Yeah, I agree.
With that sort of stuff. You know, and I've been pulling back a lot more from social media these days because I'm like, you know, instead of looking at what's viral today, I might like to rather read a book. Or look at a piece of art that's 5,000 years old and think about that.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a place to be more grounded in the physical and the things. I guess I've just been thinking a lot about the difference between something that goes viral for a couple of days and is seen, you know, millions of times versus something like a mosaic from Pompeii, which has been seen more times than that by now. And we'll still be here tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think a lot about creating for the future, making things that will last, you know, and we'll still speak to people about something that's a deeper story than this week's obsession or outrage.
Yeah.
Or celebrity. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I realized a little while ago, and I put it into a podcast, that outrage is like the mess of the internet. You know, it's you know, it's really cheap, it's really readily available, it's really toxic, you know, but it's got a lot of energy attached to it, you know?
Yeah, it does, and I believe I retweeted that when you said it. I thought that was a really good analogy. You know, and it's just funny because it's so pervasive right now, and that's really where I'm like, okay, maybe I need to step away from today's topic of outrage and just really think about things that matter more in the scheme of things. Or, you know, maybe even just a longer term view of, okay, if that, you know, if what you're mad about is actually a problem, what can we do about it long term?
I mean, that's the thing, is there are things that are bona fide outrageous that I think is absolutely worth standing up and talking about. But it gets lost in this sea of people angry at each other about what kind of carbs they eat, you know, and stuff like that. You know, can we get some kind of recognition that some things matter more than others? I don't know. I think that's internet heresy, though. But
I think it's a good grounding for making work that will sell. I was talking about, you know, let me reverse that. The stuff that sells for gazillions of dollars in auction right now is very of the moment and very fashionable, but there's no guarantee that it's really going to matter down the road, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know yet, and maybe it will, maybe it won't. We don't know. You know, but at the same time, it's like, you know, things like a Picasso or a Van Gogh or whatever, you know, those are going to stick around. You know? Mm-hmm. Unlikely they'll go too far out of fashion for, you know, reasons that are deeper than just an idea or a fashion. You know.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, they survived their stories. I mean, they were accompanied by a story, you know, about where art was going and, you know, what was new and what was old-fashioned, and that's great and good, but both of those artists really transcended and outlived the stories that were being told about what art was supposed to be in that, you know, in that period. And of course, poor old Van Gogh never got to really enjoy any of it, but, you know,
Picasso did okay.
And frankly, probably worked it beautifully, you know, either.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a consummate salesman, really. Yeah. I mean, if you sort of, you know, it's like prior to him, I don't think anybody had made money on that scale with art, except maybe Michelangelo.
Mm-hmm. It was another, you know, very smart businessman.
Yeah, he was, you know, and a very inventive person who, you know, had, you know, more going than just the ability to paint or sculpt.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, and I'm not saying maybe these would be things that don't ever work for anyone, but have you tried some things to market your art that just, they didn't fit? They were not good for you.
Oh, dozens of times, you know, I remember when we first had our first big copycat of the Fireballs, and everybody's like, well, you know, if you're so creative and an artist, why don't you just make something else then? And that's a valid question, except that I've made thousands of other things, and a lot of them sold, but none of them in quantity. You know, a lot of them were one-offs, or, you know, some of them were series. But, like, you know, I used to make masks out of shovel blades because it fit. It's face-shaped. People really liked those, but about the most you could expect to sell them for was like $75 or $100, and in a lot of ways, they were harder to do than the Fireballs.
Right.
So, you know, they, from a commercial perspective, when I was doing it because they were fun to make, they're great. Yeah. But, you know, to do them as a business thing, not so good. Or, you know, years ago, I invented a mood ring that instead of telling you what mood you're in, it had little emoticons in it, and you would swap them out to tell people what mood you were in. It was a brilliant idea. And we had them made in out of, you know, surgical stainless, and they had like a, you know, cap that screwed on and off with a glass face. They were beautiful. But to make a profit on them, we had to sell them for $80, and it turned out that what they appealed to was kids, not the 20 or 30 somethings that use the internet that I thought they would.
Right.
And nobody's going to buy an $80 ring for a kid.
Yeah.
So many things. There are so many things where it's like, okay, I've tried to design another repeatable product, like, you know, or the flat pack Fireball. I spent $30,000 developing that, and I've sold two. So big net loss. And the stability of the Fireballs allows me to have the cash to experiment about once a year with something different. But, you know, nothing else has really quite been as steady for me as that. And, you know, some other experiments were like with advertising that didn't really do anything or,
Did you ever do much with a gallery model? I mean, outside of like a site, like a you know, One Kings Lane, did you ever have your work in a gallery? And
When I started out, that was the only market there was, you know.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And actually, a really interesting thing I thought of years ago that I like to point out. So in the gallery model, right, there's like about three different levels. You could be showing work in your studio and be the gallery, and you're going to get a handful of people come by, right? Mm-hmm. But the only work for sale is you. Or, you know, you can put it in a local gallery, a regional gallery, and you'll get a lot more traffic, and it's people coming to look to buy art. But there are other artists selling there too. And so also there's a commission fee. Or you can put it in a gallery district, like, you know, Soho or, you know, River North in Chicago or whatever. Now there are a lot of galleries with a whole lot more artists, but it's a destination, so way more people come.
Mm-hmm.
And hypothetically, you'll do better, but way more competition. The internet is exactly the reverse. You know, I make the bulk of my sales through my site where people come looking for me.
Yeah.
I make a good number of sales on One Kings Lane or Frontgate, but, you know, there's way more products to buy, so they don't sell as much of my stuff. Or then you've got Etsy, where I sell fewer things, but they still, you know, way more people come to Etsy looking for art, but I'm lost in the... So, you know, it's the bricks and mortar thing is, like, in the art market, in my opinion, sort of the exact opposite of the internet, you know, and now that we live in upstate New York, it's like, I would like to get more work into galleries here. I kind of quit doing it because usually stuff is on consignment, and then you have to keep to, like, if I sell everything myself, then I, you know, nothing ships until it's paid for. I only keep one set of books, you know, if people buy it, I make it, you know, when things are on consignment, now I have to keep track of where it all is and whether or not it has sold. And that just felt like too much work. But, you know, now that we live in an area where there are a lot of really good galleries, I think it would be work that's worth doing.
You know,
where it was not so much in Michigan or when I had to drive to, you know, Chicago 6 hours away to put stuff in a gallery.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe in a 50-mile radius, we'll do that. And it gives me, you know, the last bunch of years I've been telling galleries that, you know, I won't do consignment, but if you purchase a minimum order, I'll give you, you know, your discount. I might do consignment again, but only locally, because it just doesn't make sense to, you know, spend $200 or $300 to ship stuff with no guarantee. And, you know, I had a couple experiences too in the early days where galleries, you know, good galleries where I sold work, who had work of mine in stock, closed and never got the work back to me. And all of a sudden, I'm out thousands of dollars worth of inventory, and I never did cover any of that. You know, and it was especially hurtful because the gallery owner, in the instance I'm thinking most about, was actually a good friend. I'm just like, what the hell, yo? I mean, obviously your gallery closed, you're going through some transition and stuff, but
where's my stuff?
Where's my stuff and what happened to our trust here?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. So yeah, I mean, there are, you know, and there are advantages. Here I'm ragging on galleries. There are a lot of advantages too. I mean, they've got better real estate than you do, probably.
Right.
They've got better lighting than you probably do. They've got staff.
They got great salespeople.
Press releases. Yeah.
You know. If you've got a good gallery, I mean, they have some master salespeople.
Who
in a lot of cases can articulate what's amazing about you maybe better than you can in a lot of cases.
For a lot of artists, definitely, right? And then you've got people like me that will sweat a paragraph for a year until it's right and then memorize it. But, you know, sure, they're taking 30 or 50%, but they're, you know, that's covering the cost to do all the stuff you don't want to do. And if you're going to do what I did and go solo, then, you know, you've got to do all that work that they were doing.
Right.
It's a lot of work. And you've got to gamble your money on things like advertising and site design, and, you know, because it is a gamble. In inverse proportion to how much time you put in and work you actually do.
Yeah.
I mean, the more work you do, the less of a gamble it is.
Right.
But still.
But you're gambling your time. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, gambling time and money.
Yeah.
I guess what we've done for a long time is we've always had a balance where it's like my main income comes from retail over the web, but we had, you know, other sites that sold our stuff or catalogs or galleries. And it's always been probably, you know, about 80-20. 80% mm-hmm. is me, 20% is them. And that's why we're kind of thinking about maybe just going exclusive and only selling it ourselves, you know, because we could actually hypothetically lower the price if we didn't have to give half of everything that sells through another venue to somebody else.
Right.
I mean, that's another thing artists need to know is you've got to price your stuff before you've got a gallery, before you've got a sales partner, before any of that. You've got to price your work high enough that if somebody is taking half, you're still making a profit.
Right, right.
You know, and one of the first things I did when I was making enough money to actually be legally required to pay taxes, which was not the first couple of years I was an artist. I mean, the first couple of years were really bad. But as soon as I had to file taxes, I got a freaking bookkeeper and accountant.
Right.
And, you know, they're not cheap.
Yeah.
But, you know, A, it's such a rarity to make a living in art that I'm just always in fear that I'll be audited, even though our books are really clean. I don't even take cash money because I've got no good way to tell the accountant about it. So I just don't do it.
Yeah.
It's like checks or credit cards only. But anyway, you know, get an accountant, do a P&L statement. You know, you're allowed to write off an incredible amount of stuff as an artist that you can't in most businesses. Like I can write off DVDs because that's research.
Right.
And, you know, if they ever question it, it's not like I couldn't show a dozen ways it relates directly to what I do to make a living.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
I mean, it's a valid expense. And also, I have a cap on how much I'm going to spend for a movie. So it's not like I'm screwing them. but anyway, when you've got a couple years data like that, you can look at exactly how much you brought in the year, exactly what it cost you to make that. And you can really, at that point, figure out really where you need to price your work to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're really just guessing in the beginning.
Because you're thinking,
I should get paid this much an hour and my materials cost this. But you're not thinking about your electric bill. You're not thinking about the floor space that you're paying for your studio.
Right,
you're not thinking about your internet. You're not thinking about, you know, there's so many things that you just can't really see until you really have good books.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
again, the whole feeding yourself and living indoors, you know, like.
Yeah, you know. I mean, you know, there's what it takes to run your business and make your art, and then there's what it takes to live and hopefully not in a shack.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's, you know, where do you actually want to be after that? Do you maybe want to save something for retirement? which I, you know, I haven't done. I guess I'll have to sell my art collection. But if it comes to that, right? But then again, I don't really expect to retire.
Yeah.
You know, I do what I want to do. So why wouldn't I keep doing that until I die doing it?
Like the guy who made the big blue horse outside the Denver airport, whose horse fell on him and killed him.
Oh, wow.
He was a sculptor.
With the red eyes?
Yes, exactly. That crazy thing.
Oh, my God. I saw that thing, and I thought it was incredibly satanic looking.
It is. Well, it killed the guy who made it. So, you know.
It's spooky and cool. I actually like it, but I'm like, wow, no wonder its eyes glow red.
Yeah, exactly. That thing's really infused,
with some
dark energy. But there's somebody,
just
who died.
Using the phrase murder horse the other day for some reason. Oh my God, that's funny. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got 6 stitches in my hand right now because of an accident in the studio. I don't know, the first 10 years or so, I think I got stitches about annually. And it's been 5 years, so I figure I'm doing pretty good, actually.
Yeah, you're lucky you didn't have like 5 years worth all at once.
Oh God, you know. It's not like a horrible injury, but it does take me out of the studio for a week.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I wonder, you and I met face-to-face at South by Southwest. Let's say you're at South by, I don't know if you still go, and, you know, some lovely 18-year-old passionate artist comes up to you and says, John, you know, what advice would you give me about being an artist? Do you ever give advice to those folks? And if so, what would it be?
Yeah, of course I do. I kind of feel, I had a site called Art Heroes Radio, where most of the advice I would ever give is contained in, I don't know, somewhere around 25 interview podcasts I did for a year or two. And I really enjoyed that, but I sort of thought that maybe I would do the same kind of thing that Cleon is doing, you know, do a podcast, write a book, et cetera. And I kind of realized, and, you know, I used to speak at conferences like South By or Chris Guillebeau's thing. And I kind of realized that, you know, I guess I feel like my time is better spent doing the art and all of that. So I'm actually really glad I did not become a go-to business guru for artists. I mean, this is the first interview I've done on this topic. And
yeah, I know. Thank you.
Three or four years. And it's
very
just because I like you. But, all the things that we've already talked about, of course, you know.
Yeah.
One piece of advice Cleon has that's really good that I have not observed. My overhead is insanely high because of the materials I chose to use. But, you know, if you can keep a low overhead, that makes it a lot easier in the beginning.
Yep.
And, you know, I did have, like, our old house, the mortgage on 3 buildings and 2.5 acres was just under $300 a month. So, I mean, but you get what you pay for.
Right.
He says as a very loaded cautionary tale.
Right. Well, that's,
Not have neighbors and, you know.
And I love, you know, minimalism. I love that model, but I think that maybe not enough people are talking about there are some costs, you know, to cutting it that bare. And so you have to decide whether you're willing to pay the cost or not. And sometimes the answer is no, sometimes it isn't.
You know, and I mean, in your 20s or, you know, you start an 18-year-old artist, it's like, sure, move to a really dicey neighborhood, get some cheap rent, work your ass off, see what you can do. But, you know, I'm closer to 50 than 40. I don't actually know. I try not to know. But somewhere in the next 2 to 5 years, I'll be 50. And I'm, you know, frankly, too old to do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun. It's fun when you're little. You know, closer to the ground and you bounce back faster. but, you know, you maybe want to plan for that because I didn't. It took me a long time to get out of that. You know, there's, you know, probably some PTSD associated with some of that at this point. That was avoidable, entirely avoidable. You know, so, you know, maybe instead of quitting your job and going full bore, you want to get a job that leaves you enough energy to work.
Yes.
Or, you know, one thing that drove me when I was younger was, like I said before, everybody's like, oh, you'll never make a living as an artist. That just enraged me.
Mm-hmm.
So going and, you know, spending 10 hours a day counting commute to work and then working another 10 hours in the studio every freaking day, right? And having very little social life and like 4 hours of sleep a night and all of that. That was a lot easier when I was angry enough and had something to prove.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, the flip side is once you've found a way to be more successful, you know, you don't have to work 18 or 20 hours a day anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten to where all of the business stuff is efficient enough that, you know, none of it's automated. It's surprising how there's always something that's an exceptional issue.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
You know, like, happens a lot with shipping where it's like, you've solved that problem, but here's a guy that lives at the top of a mountain. The truck can't get to. What are you going to do about it? Or, you know, somebody who left for Europe for 6 months the day they placed an order that needs to be signed for.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, stuff like that. You know, so it's never, you can never quite automate everything. You always have to be involved personally. You know, and I've done things like hire assistants or whatever, and in the end, I found that it was, a lot of the time, it was just easier to do it myself.
Right.
I hate to say that, even with really competent people.
Yeah.
Because I knew what I wanted and how I wanted it. Oh, here's another thing for artists, too. So, like this big commission that I just did, you know, it was a huge venue, Stagecoach Festival, and, you know, I only had like 24 hours to do the proposal because it was a real last minute thing that they came to me. And this piece shouldn't even have been possible in the time frame we pulled it off. But, you know, impossibility remediation is my specialty, as it says on Twitter, my bio. I figured out a way to make it work. But, you know, in the beginning, it's really tempting to do contests or to, you know, do proposals for grants or for public art projects or that kind of thing. And I've done all of that. I've applied for every grant worth applying for. And, you know, I landed some regional grants in Chicago that were nice and helpful in the beginning. But, you know, did I get an NEA grant? No, I did not. You know, competition's pretty stiff. But the thing is, proposals, commissions, grants, public art proposals, all of those things, if you do them well enough that you've got even a shot of landing the gig, you know, a grant can take 100 hours.
Right, right, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Literally. And there is no guarantee you're going to get paid.
Yeah.
You know, at all. In fact, the odds are really, really tiny. So, you know, I kind of eventually decided that, you know, maybe it was better to spend that time making art or working on the business or selling art. Mm-hmm. I think there's this fantasy artists have that they'll get this great grant or residency and they'll be set. And, you know, yeah, if you got one of the major grants, odds are you're pretty well set for a bit. But it's a lot more of a gamble and a lot more work than you could possibly imagine. And honestly, you're a lot more likely to be set if you just work hard every day and sell your work.
You know? And I gotta say, that's not just art.
No, I mean, that's everything.
A whole lot of people have plus to people.
You know, it's just that, you know, there's this lottery for these big,
right.
you know, and a lot of artists think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
You know, I also would caution against art school. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, it's crazy expensive, and you're going to come out with a lot of debt. You know, to whatever's in fashion is going to get pretty well rammed down your throat. And yeah, you know, you're going to learn a lot, but you're also, a lot of what would have made you uniquely you might get washed out in the process. You know, the upside is that art school has tools and machinery that you can't possibly afford on your own starting out.
Right.
But, you know, maybe you just want to take a couple classes and that kind of thing, or work with another artist who has that as an assistant, or, you know, because my theory was, you know, buy a lot of coffee table art books and a lot of tools and a lot of material.
Yeah.
Put my money into an education that deepened what I already cared about and gave me the tools to make something about it.
Yeah.
There's just so many ways that artists can spend money to try and further their career, but but really buying materials and buying tools is your best bet. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, things like a really good website. And, you know, the odds of you doing your own website and having it be brilliant are, you know, unless design is a big part of your education and your practice, you're better off, you know, getting a pro for it. I really had to suck it up to learn that one, too. I thought it was really great because I'd been making a living in, you know, design for, I was like, oh, you know, I can do this. And, you know, at one point in time, you know, it's like I had the TypePad Hacks website and I knew more about the TypePad platform than anybody who didn't work there in the world, you know. And did that on the side, too, for a living. But, you know, all that said, I'd really rather at this point not do my own code.
Right.
You know, there comes a time and, you know, where's my time better spent?
I think that's
the bulk of, nice. You know, what I would say to a younger artist. And if they've enjoyed our conversation and want more ideas I would have that I forgot to mention, the Art Heroes Radio podcast is a good place to look too. It's no longer being made though. It still exists. All the episodes are up there and it's like, you know, I had so much fun doing it, but it was one of those things too, where I was like, oh, I'll talk on the phone for an hour. How hard can that be?
Right.
You know, with somebody really smart, that's fun. But I was also producing it. And so I had to write the show notes and blah, blah. You know, it ended up being like 29 hours of prep.
Yeah.
For an hour of conversation. And hey, that's a whole work week.
Right. Exactly.
I guess that's one last piece of advice for artists or anybody. It's like, you know, there are buried costs in anything you do.
Yeah. Yes.
And you really aren't going to see them going in.
Right.
You know, but you need to sort of periodically assess, is this still working for us? Or, you know, you really got to look at that stuff. It's so sneaky.
Well, this has just been a total kick and so much fun. I enjoyed talking to John. John is just, he's fun to talk to, as you guys can guess. So I'm glad he said yes when I said, golly gee, would you ever do my podcast? So appreciate that very much. Just to let you guys know that the Confessions of a Pink-Haired Marketer are brought to you by the Rainmaker Platform, the complete website solution for content marketers and online entrepreneurs and creative people like you. Find out more and take a free 14-day test drive at rainmaker.fm/platform. And John T. Unger, thank you so much for joining us. I really had fun. Take care, everybody.